Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CBI at 10. I'm James Harding. I'm the editor of Tortoise, and for a fair while now, we've been working with the CBI to try and make sense of the world that's coming at us. Sometimes it feels like from every direction, and I'm really pleased that Anna Leach, the deputy chief economist at the CBI, is here today. Good to see you again. And Mike, I expect that through the corridors of the ONS, people in the last 6-12 months have been shouting, get me the head of inflation statistics. What is going on? Well, we're delighted that we have the head of inflation statistics in Mike Hardy. And Mike, I wonder whether we can start with you, because in this half hour, we're really trying to make sense of not just what the numbers are telling us, but where they're headed. So will you start with just explaining the different inflation metrics and what you think they are telling us?
Thank you, James. So we produce a range of consumer price statistics. So the measure that most people will be familiar with is the Consumer Prices Index, which is the Bank of England's inflation target and is widely covered in the media when we release our consumer price statistics every month. I just wanted to highlight a couple of other measures. So we also have the CPIH, which includes a component of owner-occupiers' housing costs. So that's the cost associated with owning, maintaining and living in your own home. And as an organisation, we see that as the most comprehensive measure of inflation. We also have a set of measures called the household cost indices, and those are designed to measure the changing costs and prices faced by different household types. For the purpose of this morning's briefing, I'm going to focus on CPI, as that's what most people are familiar with. So the latest figures we have are for the year to March, and that shows that prices increased by 7% over the last year, and that's the highest rate since 1992. So you can break our inflation statistics down into different categories. So if you look at the 12 divisions, which is the layer below our headline rate of inflation, and at that level, you're looking at things like transport, clothing, footwear, food and non-alcoholic beverages. Six of those categories made their largest contribution to the headline rate of inflation for over 10 years. So the recent rises that we are seeing are broad-based, and they are large. But I just wanted to dig into two particular divisions. So the first is transport. So we've seen quite large increases, as many people will be able to relate to, in petrol and diesel prices. So for petrol, they currently stand at 160 a litre, and for diesel, 170 a litre, and they are the highest on record. So we've been collecting data since 1990 and 1988, respectively, for those indices. We're also seeing, again, which I think people can relate to, quite large increases in electricity and gas prices. So they've increased by just under 25% over the last year. But we're also seeing increases from other areas of the basket, so clothing, footwear, food and alcoholic beverages, restaurants and hotels. So this really is a broad-based increase in inflation. I just wanted to cover a couple of other statistics as well. So we also produce business prices. So two buckets of statistics there. So the first is output prices or factory gate prices. So that's the price leaving the factory gate. And we've seen quite large price increases over the last year also. So in the year to March, and prices increased by just under 12%. And we also produce a set of statistics for input prices. So how the prices of all the goods used in the manufacturing process have changed over the last year. And we're also seeing quite large increases there. So in the year to March, those prices increased by 19.2%. So we're seeing quite large price increases on the consumer side, but also on the business side as well.
So just a few things just to follow up on that, and I'm going to come to you, Anna, in a moment, because these things are pretty jaw-dropping in a lifetime that for most of us, for most adults, has been a period of very, very low inflation. Mike, can I just understand a few things? Of the 12 divisions, you said six have been registered really the highest rises in prices for 10 years. What are the six divisions where you're not seeing such high price rises?
So we are seeing price rises in those divisions, but to a lesser extent. So it is broad-based, the increases. So all categories are contributing to the 12-month increase in inflation, but to varying degrees. And the six that I mentioned have experienced the largest contribution to the 12-month rate for over 10 years.
So there's nothing that's not seeing inflationary pressures of some sort, form or other. Can you just explain the link between the business prices, the input prices, and CPI in the sense that if you've got factory gate prices rising by 12% or input prices, as you said, by 19.2%, would that not suggest that the future consumer prices are yet to re are still to res rise further?
So it's not an exact science, but economists tend to see our business prices as a lead indicator of inflation. So they will look at how those prices are changing and how they feed through then to our consumer prices. But it's difficult to pinpoint exactly how they will feed through because there's a range of other factors having an impact on our consumer prices. But if input prices are increasing for businesses, then they either have to absorb the costs or pass them on to consumers.
And just one other thing, CPIH, what's that rise been to March, and what does that tell us about who's experiencing a cost of living crisis?
So it's identical to CPI apart from that owner occupiers housing element that I mentioned. So that's 6.2% in the year to March. Very similar drivers because they are fairly similar indices. I just want to highlight the household cost indices, which we are due to publish at the beginning of May. So they are specifically designed to unpick the change in prices and costs faced by different households. So we break those measures down by, for example, income decile, so how much people earn, expenditure decile, whether a household has pensioners or whether a household has children or not. So there are a variety of different groups that we break those household cost indices down into. We had to suspend them over the pandemic period because they were quite difficult to produce because of some of the contingency plans that we had to put in place to maintain the production of our lead measures of inflation. But we are due to publish those at the beginning of May. So I'd encourage people to look at those.
As in next week.
Yeah, so
Okay.
throughout the month, I believe.
Mike, let's come back to that in a moment if we can. But Anna, what's what you're hearing and what do you make of this quite exceptional inflation picture?
Well, it's definitely consistent with what we hear from businesses. That input inflation rate that Mike mentioned, companies have been experiencing substantial increases in front-end costs for over a year now. First, it was in relation to pandemic-related supply chain disruption, all those stories about shipping container price increases and the availability, the cost of air freight because of the reduction in air freight capacity, because of no passenger flights to stick your goods onto. All of that has been a story we've been hearing for over a year. And then, of course, the war in Ukraine has doubled down on those other cost prices by adding in very significant increases in oil, metal, food prices as well. So it all drives back into those substantial inflation rates that we've just heard read out. In input price inflation, that's the strongest since 1997. Factory gate prices are rising at the fastest pace since the financial crisis. And there are no signs of those pressures alleviating.
And Anna, the argument, if you read the Economist cover, the bank that failed, the argument that actually I think we've spoken about a few months ago, which was all of this 2021 economist thinking that inflation was going to be transitory, this was a post-pandemic blip. But that's clearly not the case. It clearly has moved into wage pressures and something more structural. What's your read of the relationship between input prices, factory gate prices, consumer price increases, and what businesses are experiencing in terms of wage pressure?
Yes, it's a complicated one, as Mike has said. You definitely wouldn't tend to expect to see a one-for-one pass-through because that's not how businesses operate. When businesses are facing these kinds of substantial increases in costs, they have choices that they can make. You can look around for different suppliers. You can change your manufacturing mix. You can invest in technology that is more productive. Makes more efficient uses of units. So over time, you have choices that you can make, which affect how those costs that you see in the headline numbers ultimately pass through to the consumer. And the consumer then can also make choices. Every year that the ONS update the consumer spending basket, the proportion of money that the consumer spend on things changes year to year, and that affects ultimately how the impact of inflation plays through too. So there's a hell of a lot that goes into how that affects spreads through the economy overall. And hindsight is 2020, as everyone says. So I mean, yes, the Bank of England could have arguably moved sooner on inflation, but the pandemic, you know, 1 in 300 year event, is pretty hard to predict how those how long the supply chain disruption was going to persist for, and how long the likes of China were going to persist with like a zero COVID policy, doubling down on that kind of disruption. But we're definitely in a very high risk place now.
And what do you hear when you are talking? I imagine that quite a few CBI members are coming to you and saying, look, this is what we're experiencing. And keen to hear from you what it means for the kind of medium, longer term outlook for the economy. What do you hear and what do you tell them?
Well, we're actually in the middle of updating the CBI's forecast right now. So the next one's going to be published in a little over a month. Because consumer inflation has risen so rapidly and is expected to remain very high throughout this year, in part because of, you know, gas, electricity prices, are not showing material signs of coming down, that, you know, that speaks to another substantial rise in the Ofgem price cap, keeping inflation, you know, 7 or 8% through the entire year. So that comes straight off consumer spending growth, and consumer spending is 2/3 of expenditure in the economy. So that has a very significant impact immediately on the outlook for economic growth. And you've got the outlook for monetary policy is pretty uncertain despite the level of inflation, because the growth outlook has weakened materially. You still have, you know, the expectation that interest rates are going to go up, financial conditions are going to tighten further than they have already, and that's going to affect business investment, funding decisions, timing decisions, funding decisions as well. So that will weaken the economy as well. So there's a lot of downside, unfortunately, to talk to in terms of certainly the outlook for the rest of this year.
Well, let's come back before we're done at the end of the half hour. I'd like to come back to the longer term outlook, because I know Tony, the Director General of the CBI, has talked about actually what's the trend rate of growth for the UK, productivity and investment decisions, and how that's affected. But Mike, Anna just mentioned monetary policy. In order for us to understand that, we really need to understand what's driving that inflation and whether or not interest rates can do anything about it. Will you just explain a little for us of what you see being the key drivers of inflation as it stands today?
So we've already touched on some of these in terms of the recent drivers, which are transport, petrol, diesel, and energy prices. And Anna has mentioned the Ofgem price cap, which came into place on the 1st of April. So we'll pick that up in our numbers, which we published next month. That price cap affects 22 million people across the UK, and will put some upward pressure on consumer price statistics. It's not our role at ONS to forecast inflation. We tend to stay away from that. But I've seen the publicly available forecast that Anna mentioned, in terms of inflation increasing and then dropping away this year. Whether that happens will remain to be seen. Some of what we're doing at the ONS is trying to provide a range of tools so that people understand how these changes are impacting them as individuals. So on our website, we've created a personal inflation calculator. So people can go on our website and they can outline their expenditure, and then it'll give them a personal rate of inflation. And then you can compare that against the headline rate. We're also looking at a least cost index as well. So we're looking at how the price of value items are changing and how that may have an impact on people with kind of limited budget every month. So we're trying to unpick this recent rise and look at how it's impacting different people across society.
And is that available, that least cost index?
The least cost index will be published in May, but the personal inflation calculator is available. So anyone can go on our website and basically outline what they spend their money on every month, and it'll give them a personal rate of inflation.
Right. Anna, it's always the tendency, isn't it, when things are hard to control and out of our control, to try and find someone to blame. And as you said, you know, there's been this tendency to turn on the central banks. There's a risk, isn't there, from the other side of the argument, that given the drivers of inflation are, as Mike was just saying, transport, a lot to do with energy costs, that actually higher interest rates won't necessarily suppress this kind of inflation. It's not demand driven, it's driven by these input costs. What do you say to that?
In typical times, so if inflation was previously low and stable, and then we had these commodity price increases coming through, the bank would very much prefer to let the inflation just pass through the system and not change interest rates, because, as you say, it's a supply shock. Ideally, you just let that do its business and it would ultimately just self-correct without any adjustment. But because we've started from a position where inflation was already very strong, there is a concern that the fact that these new inflation pressures arising from the war lead to inflation becoming high and persistent for so long that it feeds through to significant and broad-based wage increases, because, you know, everyone wants to be able to sustain their standard of living. You want your wage settlement to match what's going on with prices, and ultimately that is the kind of wage price spiral which gives monetary policy makers a great deal of concern and pushes them to act. At the same time, we've got the shock to commodity prices is so significant that it is going to significantly dampen economic growth this year and next. The IMF published their global forecast last week. They reduced the global growth level by about a percentage point for this year, which is substantial. Normally you're looking at, you know, 0.1, 0.2, a bit of tweaking. So a 1% change is very significant. For the UK, we're looking at, you know, growth only being about 3.5% this year now. And that could basically be delivered by no growth whatsoever for three quarters of the year, just because of weird base effects around the recovery from the pandemic. And then growth next year, which is coming back to the point around Tony's concern about longer term growth and the need for action, you're looking at growth only just above 1%. And that is why there's this concern that, you know, we've got this massive, massive shock. And then beyond that, this is the scope for really sustainable growth is really poor in the UK. Hence the CBI's ongoing position that we really need to see something game changing in the policy environment.
So, and just on that, one of the arguments that I have often and generally lose is that we should take on a much higher level of debt. And I'm not asking you, Anna, to make the case now, sort of like launch into a new CBI argument on the right debt to GDP ratio. But what's the impact of for government debt when you do have higher inflation in terms of the balance between the debt receding as a result of inflation and higher interest service payment costs?
Exactly. There is that tricky balance, because on the one hand, higher inflation inflates tax receipts, you know, higher VAT receipts. You know, if wages are going up, it pushes people over income thresholds and so on. So they get a higher tax take. But it also pushes up debt interest payments, because the level of it inflates everything. So it inflates both sides. Otherwise, the big risk with debt levels is being an outlier globally. So it's okay if everyone is in the same boat. Hence, financial crisis, pandemic as well, debt levels across the advanced world in particular rose significantly, but largely to a reasonable degree in step with each other. Of course, Eurozone countries, there are outliers there. But if you're in step with everyone else and you're suffering the same shocks as everyone else, you don't get a risk premium attributed or you're less likely to get the risk premium attributed to your debt, which pushes up your debt interest payments. The issue is then if you look out of step with everyone else. And of course, the UK went into the crisis with a bit of an extra challenge to face, which was because we just left the EU as well.
Mm-hmm. So I just want, Mike, I don't know whether this is fair to ask you, because I don't know whether you track the inflation statistics of other countries, but how much are the rising prices that we're seeing more or less mirrored by rising prices in other advanced economies, or are there some areas where we're seeing it more acutely than others?
It's very similar. So most other developed economies are experiencing similar increases in inflation that we are, because of energy prices, etc., supply chain disruption. You know, for example, used car prices have grown by 30% over the last year, and that's partly attributed to supply chain disruption having an impact on the manufacture of new cars. And that's having the knock-on impact then on the second-hand car market. So there are a range of external factors. We've discussed the war in Ukraine, sanctions on Russia, that are having an impact on kind of various aspects of the basket that we use to construct our inflation estimates.
I asked about international comparison, regional comparisons between the four nations.
So we don't produce regional statistics, but one of the big work programs that we've got at the moment, we currently construct our inflation estimates by sending people out into stores across the UK to collect prices. We are working with several large supermarkets to get access to their electronic point of sale data. We're also working with Auto Trader and Rail Delivery Group to get access to their admin data, and that will allow us to produce more granular statistics such as regional data. It will also allow us to better reflect changing consumer spending patterns in real time. So Anna mentioned the basket that we use to construct our inflation statistic. So at the start of the year, we construct this large virtual basket. It consists of over 700 items, and then we track the price of those through the year, and then at the start of the following year we refresh that basket to reflect changing consumer spending patterns. So we add items, maybe there's new technology item that's come online that we want to include, but what these data sources will allow us to do is better reflect changing consumer spending patterns in real time. So now we've seen this increase in inflation, you may find, for example, that consumers are switching from premium brands to value brands, and working with the supermarkets, having that granular data, we're moving from using around 200,000 prices every month to somewhere in the regions of 700 to 800 million prices every month. And that just allows us to get a better handle on what's going on in the UK economy.
Well, can I just ask you about that? Because I saw in the sort of argument between Jack Munro and the ONS, which I saw that you came out and sort of engaged in how to get the most granular possible measurements of price rises and changes. You mentioned this increase from the number of things you're measuring. I think you said at the time hundreds of millions. I didn't realize it was 700 to 800 million different prices. What will that enable you, what's the timetable on that? But most importantly, what will that enable you to track? Presumably you're going to see patterns that we've never seen before.
Yes. So in terms of the timeline, so at the start of next year, we'll be incorporating data from Auto Trader and Rail Delivery Group. And then at the start of the following year, we'll be incorporating electronic point of sale data from supermarkets. And what that will allow us to do is basically, at the moment, we send price collectors into stores. They collect prices of a number of products. That's fairly limited, because they have limited time. But what we'll essentially have is a census of all of the prices within a supermarket. And what's really important about the data as well, it gives you the underlying quantities. So you'll be able to see how much of each individual product people are purchasing. You know, Jack Munro has highlighted, that people on lower incomes are being forced to purchase more expensive items because some of the value ranges are not available, and that will be picked up within the scanner data. But it also goes back to that least cost index that I mentioned that we do to publish next month. So we're doing some work to identify how the prices of value ranges are changing, essentially.
Anna, can I end with you, which is a sort of really big picture question? There are the energy price inputs, but then even before we talked about that as an inflationary factor, we were talking for some time about big changes in the labour market. You know, this time last year, we were talking about labour market shortages, and those pressures haven't gone away. And I wonder whether or not the combination of the two, the needs for efficiency because of energy prices, the needs for efficiencies because of the cost of labour, mean that there's the moment here for a step change in investment as companies look to see different ways to improve their productivity. And if that's the case, are we in for a rough year or two, but potentially the opportunity to change our trend rate of growth?
Exactly. It is a sort of game-changing moment. The pandemic was a particular trigger, and the impacts of the war have merely doubled down on the incentives you've just outlined. The challenge that we have, and the reason we need the government policy lever to really sort of kick the process off, is because, you know, companies are dealing with so much, they have dealt with so much disruption and costs over the last few years. They need that support to really take this opportunity forward. We've just published, day before yesterday, our manufacturing survey for April. And despite all of these cost increases, the strongest cost and price increases since the 70s, because of uncertainty about the outlook, we saw a decline in investment plans for product and process innovation, for example, and investment plans overall have weakened. And part of this is, you know, financial conditions have tightened, uncertainty is higher. There's, you know, everyone's just waiting to see what happens next. But the longer we wait, the higher the price, the higher the economic cost is. And that's why we just need the government to help companies to get there.
Anna, thank you. And Mike, thank you so much. I have to say, I can't remember a moment like this, partly post-pandemic, obviously the war in Ukraine, but also the realities of cost of living. And it's often easy just to kind of wish the whole world away and not to look in closer detail and understand it better. But just getting the chance to go through the numbers and the details behind those numbers in some granular way with you, Mike, and try and get a broader picture of what that means for business, for government and for society from you, Anna, really makes a difference. So thank you. Quite a meaningful start to the morning. I hope everyone has a very good day. But thanks very much, Anna Leach and Mike Hardy of the ONS. Thank you.